Brooklyn.
You're listening to Burning Bridges with Margot, and I'm your fire starter, Margot Avedisian. And today we have a very special guest on. We have the former COO and internal co-founder of NYT Global, International Digital Division of the New York Times. And now he's a managing partner of New Economy Lab, a social impact-focused innovation group. Welcome, James Selznick, to Burning Bridges with Margot.
Thanks. It's so
much
fun to be here.
Awesome. So I'm glad we got you. I couldn't get you when you actually were at New York Times and, you know, the NYT Global International Digital Division. And now I have you. And the media is a huge topic right now. I mean, we saw with the election, it was basically very much all Trump. And we also saw how the media kind of manipulated coverage with Bernie Sanders. And now we have fake news is very much a phrase that we hear constantly. So I was hoping you could shed some light on what is going on with the media right now. Like, who's holding the media accountable for anything? And we'll get to eventually what we can do as regular people to kind of support truth winning out in this battle.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's true that we're definitely facing a whole bunch of crises at the same time. I think as businesses, media are under incredible pressure. The old models are being disrupted. People haven't quite figured out what the new models are. And in terms of the substance of it, I think there is a real crisis of confidence in all major institutions in American life and in global life. And that definitely includes media. And I think that's reflected a lot in just opinion polling and surveying of people and what they think about their trusted news sources. And those stats have gone in a pretty southward direction since pretty much around 2000 for all kinds of reasons. I mean, some healthy and some not so healthy. You know, I think some natural skepticism about power and about, you know, authority is probably a good thing. And the fact that people have a range of media sources now that they can access much more easily, you know, sitting on the subway platform than you could before 2000, you know, that's probably a good thing. I think it's leading a lot of people to realize that, oh, well, actually, you know, sometimes there's more than one side to a story, and they start to challenge and think a little bit about who they trust and why. So that's, you know, definitely a big challenge for the sector.
Well, what about having some sort of accountability, and what happened to really journalistic integrity? I mean, news doesn't mean truth, and maybe it never really meant that, but at least when you read something, there had to be some level of truth to it. I mean, now we have stations where all they do is completely put out false information.
Yeah, look, I think that's true. I mean, there's sort of two related questions. I mean, one is, are there more false sources of news today or not? And, you know, then the second one is kind of how are we distributing this stuff, and how, you know, is it becoming more prominent and more visible? And, you know, I'm not convinced that there are more people lying about stuff today than there ever was. I think, you know, historically, all kinds of people have said all kinds of dumb things and potentially even dumber things than you find today. But I think it is true that a lot of that dumb stuff is more visible, you know, if it reinforces somebody's pre-held conceptions because they, you know, hate Hillary or they hate Bernie or they hate, you know, or like Trump, you know, they can forward it and suddenly a million people can see it before anyone's really, like you said, held them accountable for that.
But isn't that the news stations? Aren't they the ones who are supposed to be making sure that what is being put out there is actually true or accurate?
Yeah, I mean, there's a range of fact-checking and error correction and sort of accountability that really ranges by institution. I mean, the New York Times, like the Washington Post and other, you know, top media outlets, I think has probably the strongest protections around things like facts and checking. That doesn't mean they're infallible. There have been all kinds of errors and mistakes and some quite embarrassing ones in all of those publications. And, you know, also some worldview that the people that work there represent. And I think people are legitimately asking questions about those things. And when they do trip up, I think that error, that mistake is probably becoming more obvious because there are lots of people on the other side that want to really highlight that. And on the other hand, I think there's kind of, you know, organizations that make no effort at all. I mean, you know, Breitbart just engages in all-out race baiting and promulgation of, you know, falsehoods. There are, you know, random crazy Eastern European hackers that set up sites to just, you know, make stuff up totally out of whole cloth. And I think a lot has been made of that. I think, you know, they tend to be pretty small operations, and I think they just sort of tap into the fact that a lot of people will share something, frankly, without even reading it.
Well, is that even considered news, though? Like, with only one, it doesn't matter if what they're saying is fact or not. Like, is that considered news? Like, why don't we have more stringent kind of definitions of what news is? Like, how is Breitbart considered news if they have an obvious slant?
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, look, I don't know. I mean, I certainly wouldn't consider it any kind of quality version of news. I mean, it's you know, like a lot of the Murdoch properties, frankly. And by the way, you can put some quality publications in that bucket. I mean, I don't work at the Times now, so I can kind of say whatever I want about them. You know, the Wall Street Journal and the Murdoch properties engage in all-out propagandizing around climate change. They've, for many years, fought basic facts and common sense and the consensus among the scientific community, not to mention the intergovernmental organizations that focus on this, to just try to inform or misinform people that climate change is not true. I mean, this is the editorial page of one of the top and most prestigious journals in the country. So, you know, what is news, what is not news? I think that's right. It's kind of a range. Nobody's infallible. It's kind of more a matter of degrees. How careful are they? How influenced are they by their proprietors or the worldview of the people that work there? And, you know, people have to maintain that set of skepticism, I think, and decide for themselves.
So at the New York Times, is there pressure from the owners or money about what you guys should be publishing?
Look, I'm obviously biased because I work there and I have a lot of love and respect for the institution of the New York Times. I mean, my view and my personal experience was that I think they do everything they can to maintain the independence of the organization. I certainly never personally witnessed anything that, went against that, in the sense of I've certainly never heard of or seen any kind of, you know, proprietor sort of publisher sort of influence in, the way that stories are told or anything like that. Does that happen in other publications? You certainly see that sometimes. But that's also not to say that there isn't some sort of systematic kind of, you know, groupthink that goes on anywhere. You know, if you select a group of people, they live in Manhattan mostly, they're mostly fairly well off, you know, like they're going to think about the world in certain ways. Their friends are from certain milieu, and their, you know, circles that they move in are certain ways. And if kind of everyone in those circles thinks a certain thing, you're probably going to find that reflected in the assumptions that are made in some of the reporting.
Do you think the media is partly to blame for Trump being elected?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of fair. I mean, I guess like it's a hard generalization, right? Because, I mean, you know, the media, I mean, you know, what does that really mean? On one hand, you've got a large, you know, basically every publication in the country were endorsing his opponent, Clinton. So at one level, you know, the editorial pages certainly were not Trump supporters. On the other hand, I think, you know, there was a bit of a hack that his campaign style exploited. He knew he could lead them around by saying outrageous things repeatedly. And that was a tactic that worked very well for him to establish himself as this sort of bold, tell it how it is truth teller. and a lot of people bought that, you know. They kind of mistook his willingness to say things that are outrageous for sort of a willingness to tell the truth. And unfortunately, if you've spent your whole life living in areas where you haven't had the fortune of having, you know, responsible media tell stories to you in a way that you find compelling, and you've become misinformed or you've never been informed well about, you know, matters of policy, I think it's a kind of target-rich environment for someone to come in and exploit that. You know, I think one thing the media hasn't done well is kind of engage real America, you know, the middle of the country, just like the middle of the UK, just like the middle of Australia, where I'm from, you know, in a meaningful dialogue about their lives and the way that their lives interact with public policy. There's sort of there's a truth to the, you know, educated elite out of touchness, where we have our little policy discussions and our little games, and we go to college and we're educated, and no one's really bothered to tell stories for the rest of the country. The people that do that are the kind of the hacks, you know, the Murdoch tabloids, who do it because they have a political agenda. And, you know, Murdoch's very upfront about his political agenda. Centers around his own power, and it centers around his view of, you know, the need to push back on sort of liberal ideals. So that's who ends up informing these guys, and they haven't got, you know, they've got their Radio Shock jocks, and they've got their Murdoch tabloids, and they've got Fox News. And I think the rest of us haven't really made enough of an effort to find out how to work and speak to and listen to people that are different from ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because a lot of what the concerns of probably a lot of the country, we just kind of overshot that and didn't really take into account what do they want, what's going on in their lives, and how can policies kind of help them. But I mean, it was just crazy, though, how much media coverage Trump got and how little Bernie Sanders got. It was like the media made up their mind of who they wanted to win the election, and that was literally plastered on all the news channels. And yeah, that's, I think that's really unfortunate. That wasn't fair at all. Like, the candidates didn't actually get a fair platform to kind of tell what their policies were. And I mean, the New York Times, definitely they're pro-Hillary without giving Bernie Sanders a chance at all. And I don't think that was fair.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Trump and the Sanders kind of campaigns probably face different challenges and successes. I mean, you know, the Trump thing, look, I mean, the unfortunate reality is if you have a mainstream candidate leading in the opinion polls for one of America's major parties who says patently racist things, unfortunately, that's news, you know? And so I think there's a real defense as to why journalists did cover that. I mean, it was a wholly new phenomenon. It was interesting. Unfortunately, not a lot of what, you know, the Clinton campaign was saying was sort of in any way unpredictable or as newsworthy. You know, she kind of relaunched the thing a couple of times and rehashed some of the slogans we've heard before. You know, now that's no reason to kind of, it's obviously a hack because it's not fair. But in terms of newsworthiness and the job of a journalist to cover something, you know, that is newsworthy.
Yeah, but you know, that's, wouldn't you say Sanders having these giant rallies of having more people than ever come out to see him, like, isn't that news? Because the media really did not cover that. And that to me is huge news. If you're having someone who's really getting to the center of problems and having this huge, huge base, despite not having that much attention on him, and the news just kind of totally ignored it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to ask the question about what did the coverage look like in the primaries. And I think one systematic reason why a lot of what you're saying has, you know, is a valid critique, I think, is because, you know, there's sort of a systematic thing that goes on. If you're a journalist and you're a successful journalist, you develop contacts, you develop relationships, you know people in centers of power. The centers of power in the Democratic Party, which if you're a political journalist, that's what you cover, that's how you make your career. We're obviously on one side of that debate, right? That all came out. That was kind of clear at the time. That's where the endorsements came from. That's where the donors were there. They're all clearly on the Clinton side. So, you know, the first thing that I think happened systematically there is probably that the serious thinkers, in quotes, and the conventional wisdom regarded the Sanders campaign as a fringe campaign for longer than a lot of the rest of the community did. And as a result, I don't think as much serious coverage was probably given to it as they would have in hindsight given it. But I think, you know, the second thing that's going on there is also even at the editorial levels, when you're sort of staffing these campaigns, if you look at a field of candidates and the basic sort of consensus is one of them is almost certainly going to win, and you're thinking about who are you going to allocate to cover each of these these candidates, who's going to follow them around on their campaign trail, you know, you're going to put your main resources where you think the campaign's going to go, and you're going to leave less resources where you don't think it's going to go. Those judgments were clearly wrong for all the reasons you've said. But I think they're a little bit more systematic than some kind of deliberate attempt to skew the outcome.
Well, really, because I remember after the first primary debate with Hillary and Bernie, they all these different sites, including CNN, who hosted the debate, had a poll of who do you think won the debate? And Bernie won every single one by 80% or more. And every article that came out in the New York Times all wrote, Hillary obviously won. She won hands down. But every single poll, and I looked at a list someone compiled, Bernie won by over 80%. So as a journalist, what are you basing this opinion on when no one else agrees with you?
Yeah, well, you should distinguish, though, between opinion journalists and hard news journalists there. So if what you're talking about is opinion columnists, I think that's also very true. When you look at the opinion columnists in the major publications, they skewed heavily towards the Clinton campaign. No question about that. I don't think there were any staff columnists at the New York Times, to my knowledge, who were expressing support for Bernie, which, you know, means that, you know, the whole columnist slate was sort of to the right of center for the entire Democratic Party. You know, and that there's legitimate questions you could ask around that, which I think are fair. But, you know, look, yeah, that's kind of that's a fair question to ask. I mean, who the columnists are and you know, how their opinions are, you know, sit on a spectrum relative to the readership and the rest of the community. I think, you know, it's fair to ask the question, why were none of them, like, where half of the party was, at least, you know, for one of the major parties in the country. I think that's a totally fair question.
So I really, why doesn't the media push back too? Like, now that we're seeing with this whole Trump basically attacking media, and it's very reminiscent of during the Third Reich, where they were very, had so much propaganda and were cutting off news sources. And we're kind of seeing that now. I mean, remember Trump banned news organizations from a press conference. So what should the news be doing in order to fight back? Because he's putting out things that are completely not true. And someone needs to stand up to him and be like, this is not accurate, maybe more strongly than they're trying to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, right? I mean, it's definitely a huge threat when you've got the president of the country actively campaigning against, you know, the Fourth Estate and calling them the enemy of the American people and, you know, finding ways to kind of attack them on a pretty much daily basis. But, you know, you're pointing to something important here, which is like there's a kind of a natural tension. There's a symbiotic relationship to some extent between journalists and power, in the sense that they cover power, they get leaks from power, their unnamed sources, their named sources reflect relationships that they're able to build in, you know, powerful circles, right? If you're a political reporter and you don't have relationships in major political parties, you're not going to be able to file any stories that anyone's going to read. So there's that side. And then there's their role in holding power accountable. So, you know, they've kind of got this natural tension in their job between having to sort of buddy up to some extent, you know, build relationships, and at the other side of it, you know, burn these people, hold them accountable, write the headline stories that will end up, you know, leading to the downfall of their career. So I think, you know, the media are having to reassess their role in a big way with relationship to the White House right now. I mean, the fact that they're not attending the, you know, White House, you know, the correspondence dinner, I think is a sort of an illustration of how the relationship between media and, you know, the federal seat of power is evolving. It's evolving in a more adversarial direction, which, you know, is probably not a bad thing. I mean, a lot of people were a little bit sickened by the sort of, you know, sycophantic kind of spectacle of, you know, rooms full of, you know, tuxedo-wearing journalists sort of laughing along as presidents like Bush will sort of make jokes about, you know, not finding weapons of mass destruction. I think a lot of us found that a little unseemly. You know, I certainly did.
So there was kind of this a little bit of acquiesced by the press after the whole they were banned from the press briefing. So you talked about this kind of balance of being connected to power and then having to burn them. Do you think that they're maybe kind of backing off a little too much because they're afraid of being cutting off? Like, what is the balance there?
Look, it's a great question. Yeah, I mean, and I don't think there's any way to generalize. I mean, if, you know, if we're talking about the Breitbart sort of representative in the White House, you know, press briefing room, absolutely. I mean, you know, you read Breitbart, it doesn't matter what the news cycle has to say that day. It's just a defense of whatever, you know, the Trump and Bannon agenda is, you know, to the point of absurdity. I mean, they don't even have a token attempt to kind of, you know, concede that they've had a bad day ever. You know, if you're talking about the kind of Wall Street Journals and the Washington Posts and the New York Timeses, you know, I think they're doing a thoughtful kind of good job at the moment. You know, could they do a better job? I think, sure, that's definitely true. Could we have some more critical press in there? And are they occasionally kind of misstepping in ways that other more critical press will kind of call them out on? I think absolutely. I think that happens quite a lot.
Well, it's kind of crazy that, you know, Trump basically calls out news organizations and says they're fake news. So that's almost an uphill battle. You're already alienating people to what is probably the most accountable news out there.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's actually a really smart, if like evil genius strategy, right? I mean, you know, what are we? We're kind of, you know, day 40 or something, or what are we at now? 44 or something? I kind of lost count with the new administration. I mean, I think this is sheer speculation. You know, they're preparing us for the day when there is a major headline, a major story that's going to reflect incredibly poorly on them or their judgment or something they're proposing. And they're kind of preemptively, you know, knocking the credibility out of the sources that are likely to hold them accountable for that. I think when they, you know, call CNN fake news, you know, when Trump does that, and, you know, there was that great moment, I mean, horrible moment where he's, you know, screaming, shouting down the CNN correspondent in the White House press briefing, you know, saying, no, I'm not going to take a question from you. You're, you know, you're fake news. Sit down. Shut up. You know, I think he's kind of preemptively kind of inoculating his support base so that when the CNN headline comes out and it just says something unassailably awful about something he's just done or is about to do, he'll just straight out deny it the way he's denied all matters of fact, you know, from the beginning, from the birthplace of the previous president to the existence of basic scientific truths, you know. And so that's sort of that's a quite devious, quite scary game.
Wow, that gave me shivers because they are really setting it up for that. So what can news organizations do? Like, how do you fight against that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think they are doing one thing that it's probably exactly right, which is, you know, they're shifting their approach to the president. I mean, CNN got a lot of kudos, I think, for, you know, its chyrons on the screen quoting Trump. And, you know, they cottoned on to the obvious hack that he was playing through. You know, it used to be easy to run the he said, she said trick on the press where, you know, someone says the sky is blue and you just say, no, it's not. And then CNN previously would have to report, well, you know, sky blue, sky not blue, you know, according to, you know, he says sky's blue, she says sky's not blue. You know, we report, you decide. They've gotten onto that trick now. We've kind of like figured out how to respond to that. Now, you know, CNN will be happy to kind of write, you know, president says, brackets falsely, and then something, right? You know, and so that's great. No one used to do that before. You know, the New York Times has had, I think, at least one or maybe more than one front cover referring explicitly to a lie told by the president. I think, you know, Donald Trump is not the first American president to lie about important matters to the American public and to the world. But to my knowledge, is the first to be called out using that word on the front page of the New York Times. So that's an evolution in the adversarial kind of, you know, tension between power and the press.
Well, yeah, I don't think any president in their lives have been on the scale every day, like a daily thing that happens. In Twitter, we've never had a president who uses Twitter as their main means of communicating.
I know, it's true, but, you know, look, you know, to kind of play slightly devil's advocate there, I mean, in a sense, he's just a bit stupider, really. I mean, the lies of the Nixon regime or, you know, the lies around the Vietnam War, not to mention the Iraq War, I mean, in a sense, they were much more consequential because the people lying about it were better at it. You know, they were more sophisticated. They were more deeply embedded into the centers of power in the United States, the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies. You know, this president is just a clown, you know? So it's sort of more obvious when he says something absurdly ridiculous and 5 seconds later it's... I mean, you know, take the testimony by the FBI director at the House Intelligence Committee where the president literally tweets, you know, Jim Comey has just agreed that I was right. And then the questioning is still going on. So that one of the questioners says to Jim Comey, so the president just tweeted that you've admitted that he was right. Is that right? And, you know, the FBI director live just has to say, no, it's absolutely not. You know, like that's not a clever strategy for lying. He's kind of a clown, you know, but we're going to have better, more devious demagogues in the future. So hopefully this process of taking a more evolved relationship with the press, you know, hopefully, you know, we'll kind of stand us in better stead if that happens. I don't know. Maybe that's the optimistic spin.
Well, don't you think in a way, though, it's numbing us? Because it's just constant that he's doing and saying something crazy or lying that really you just become used to it.
Yeah. I mean, but in a way, even some of that numbing is kind of interesting, right? I think we've seen recently that the press has kind of stopped chasing every stupid thing he says because there's now just a general recognition that the guy is a clown and that's not news anymore. That was kind of news when he was a new candidate, when he was new president, when he was in the transition period. You know, it's barely, you know, into the second month of this presidency and it's just no longer news anymore when the current president of the United States says a demonstrably false thing that he knows is false, that is stupid. So it's not really being reported as news anymore. Now, I think people are focusing on the main game of, you know, how that influences the, you know, the distribution of power and likely outcomes politically on the Hill and in the White House.
Yeah, I'm still very much worried. I really do think the press should be a little more. I mean, they're getting tough, but it's absurd. Like, so many things that are going on are absurd, and I really wish it was just getting to the rest of the country. Like, this is absurd. This is not, this is not real.
You know? Yeah, well, you're putting your finger on something really important. I mean, this filter bubble problem is a really, really major one. I mean, we do have a very divided audience now, in a very divided country, where red state news readers live in a very different fact universe from the rest of the world. So I think, you know, it almost doesn't matter how tough the New York Times and CNN are on the president if half the country never see that or never learn about it, because, you know, people sitting in Manhattan are all going to vote against him anyway, and we can sit here getting even more and more upset about him. But I mean, how do we reach people on the other side is really the more consequential question. You know, that's a harder one.
Well, doesn't that kind of bring to this whole fake news thing and with Russia interfering in our election? And essentially it was having all these people bombard fake news, and they broke into voting registers so they could knew what direction people went to. Like, I'm sure I was very much a Bernie supporter. I don't know if you got that. And
have you noticed I've dodged the question entirely?
And I'm sure they targeted me with anti-Hillary things. And they just created all this fake news and targeted people specifically. So I wonder if there's any way we can take a model from that to get to people as well. But it is scary. It's scary that our information is extremely tainted and targeted to us by another country.
It's amazing. I mean, you know, that kind of spammy fake news stuff. Yeah, you know, it was a problem and it did have an impact. It's, you don't want to underestimate that. But I think it's also been a little overplayed. You know, there have been good studies that have shown that, you know, people kind of reshare anything that has a headline that sort of supports what they already think. And it's less clear that anybody's mind was changed by fake news stories. You know, there was a good study that was done. I can't quote the reference, but they compared fake news with what they called fake news, where what they did was they took actual fake news, as in fake news stories that spread virally, that really did spread virally, and they asked people if they recalled them, and, you know, saying that something bad about Hillary or whatever it was. And then they made up a fake news story that had actually never been shown to anybody before, and they asked people if they recalled seeing that. And so everyone got initially quite freaked out that the fake news stories that did spread were being recalled by the audience, and so kind of influencing the way they thought about the world. It turned out when they showed people fake news stories that had never actually been shown to anyone, they responded in pretty equal numbers to it. What it turned out they were responding to was really just, you see a headline that kind of confirms what you think, and you're like, oh, yeah, that's right, yeah, you know.
Confirmation bias.
Yeah, confirmation bias. And so that kind of points to maybe we're asking not always exactly the right questions. You know, maybe we need to be asking questions about how do we identify content that persuades people on the other side better? How do we package content in ways that gets through them? And potentially, how do we redesign our social news sharing platforms so that instead of just encouraging people to form these bubbles where they clap and cheer as the news sources throw red meat to the masses, and anything that kind of screams with a headline that makes you excited about, you know, your side winning or your side being right about something, you know, how do we change the dynamics, the gamification of those, so that we can incentivize the creation of content and the distribution of content to friends that breaks across that filter bubble, you know? And I think there are answers to that, but, you know, they have to start by asking the right questions. Facebook and, in fact, most standard news outlets, really all their incentives and all of their product metrics are around engagement and virality. And, you know, those two things naturally lead you down the filter bubble route, because what's the most viral stuff? What's the stuff you want to click on? You know, the stuff that confirms what you think. So, you know, we all want that. We all want a lot of that. But can we find ways to build into these products and these experiences, you know, mechanisms to draw out a couple of these subtler signals? Like, okay, well, you know, maybe I didn't clap and cheer and stand on the table and wave this in front of me when I saw this article. But, you know, it actually made me think a little bit differently about the healthcare debate. And if I can just tap into that moment, you know, maybe that kind of article, that, oh, I just learned something, that moment, you know, might be the basis of a different kind of metric we could use to try to identify content that does break through.
Yeah, I think trust has a lot to do with it. And, you know, as Trump is breaking down the trust of certain news organizations to his followers or whatever, but having some sort of, this is completely fact-checked, or I've been trying to think about, like, what's something that people could see and they're like, there's no way that this is inaccurate, you know, if it was whether different journalists signing off on it, or people in the area who like live in a town where they're writing a story about it, or having more citizen journalists in a way kind of contribute to what is actually going on. Like I'm in blockchain and there's a lot of stuff right now with prediction models, and Gnosis is one, and it's based on the blockchain and Ethereum, and people vote and you get rewarded for real information opposed to what you want to happen. And so I wonder if there's some sort of way, like maybe new model, where people can get information and news, and it's maybe less about who the organization is and having that kind of level of truth, because really, I mean, Fox News doesn't, but people religiously believe that. So maybe breaking out of these traditional media conglomerates and having maybe some more grassroots type of way to get information.
Yeah, I mean, I think trust is definitely at the core of that, you know, the value of news, and the, you know, the best proxy that we have for truth is trust. You know, I mean, I love these kind of discussions because, like, I feel like it's kind of like brings me back to philosophy class. You know, we're like, literally it's a top issue in the world today. Like, what is truth and how do you find it? You know, like when do we ever think that epistemology, you know, 101 would sort of become a hot, you know, political topic? But yeah, I mean, that's right. Like, you know, people land at different places on this. I mean, there are extreme relativists that just say there is no truth and you can never find it and it's all relative. I don't believe that. I don't think anybody actually believes that. You know, anyone who's runs out of a building that's on fire or makes any decision in their life about their medical, you know, clearly they're operating under some sense that truth is a thing that you can strive for. But we can never be totally sure about what it is, right? And I think, you know, it's easier, I think, when you look back historically. I mean, think about the kinds of things people believed 50 years ago, 100 years ago. You know, there's really no mechanism voting or trustworthy or what's the right source. You know, they were just wrong about a whole bunch of stuff, and they were going to be wrong about it for 100 years. And so, you know, today we're equally probably wrong about a whole bunch of stuff, and there's probably fringe people that think a couple things that we're all going to think later. I mean, you know, gay marriage was sort of a completely fringe idea 20 years ago, you know, when I was in school. You know, climate change was sort of, you know, went on an evolution like that. I mean, even interracial marriage was opposed by majorities of Americans as late as the 1980s. Not just opposed like I don't want to do it, opposed like it shouldn't be legal. So, you know, we have this search for truth and this search for, you know, what's fair, but, you know, really it's the processes and the mechanisms and the institutions that are the best you can do. And I think you're right to point to trust as something that we want to, you know, we want to hold up. I think this kind of blind alley of, you know, let's, you know, you see a lot of computer science people, you see a lot of West Coast technology people going down this route. It's like, let's build a machine to automatically figure out what's true. You know, it's like, I don't even want to spend half an hour having that conversation because, like, it's not possible. It's kind of a little misguided. How does the machine know what's true? Half the things are not necessarily about true or false. If you look at Breitbart, I mean, do it. It's an interesting exercise. Anybody should do it to see what's on there. Most of the stuff's really not that it's actually untrue. It's just that it's misleading. You know, they'll focus on part of the story, or they'll emphasize something that's ridiculous, or they'll hold up examples of, here's a group we hate. Look, I found one example of that person doing a bad thing, and I'm going to make a headline out of it. And, you know, it doesn't say, like, all bad things are done by this group, or this group is mostly bad, but that's the conclusion that it leads the readers to come to. Oh, every time I read an article about that group, you know, they're beating somebody up, or they're doing something, you know, violent. So, you know, the fact-checking doesn't necessarily get to that.
Well, it may be slant-wise an opinion that's interjected into the article.
Right. I mean, but that's right. So, you know, yeah, how do you make a machine to kind of check whether your slant is right or wrong? I don't know.
Yeah, well, not so much of a machine, but, you know, maybe there's like a group of people, like journalists signing off on stuff or like reading it and being like, oh, I've been covering this. This seems a little more slanted, or just even having people kind of vote on articles, almost having like ratings. I don't want to say like Yelp, but something that kind of, look at like Amazon reviews, right? Like people really care about these reviews. And I've noticed if you read the reviews, I like reading the reviews to see even seamless. Jesus Christ, I'm always reading those reviews. But on Amazon, they'll have at the end saying, I was given, you know, the product to try, but my opinion is not reflected because of that. And so those reviews are kind of slanted, but having people kind of review things, review information and trying to even like crowdsourcing information. I mean, even as a reporter, that seems something that could be helpful, right?
I think that's a great idea. I mean, you know, you're pointing to something that we're going to have to get much smarter at. I mean, previously the way that was done, you know, those reviews were just the reputation of the journalist. You know, if a great journalist wanted to win a prize and get a gig, you know, higher up the totem pole, they had to write great stories. So people kind of reviewed them by just sharing them around and people knowing about them, and their name kind of sticks in your head a little bit more. And if they did anything dumb, you know, they'd get kind of whacked. Like, oh my God, that journalist that we thought was great, what a mess up. You know, they reported this and that wasn't true, or they made this obvious mistake, or their source was, you know, leading them down a garden path. So I think that system kind of, we had that almost automatically when there were fewer publications and they were, you know, high quality publications and everybody read the same things and the journalists were kind of superstars. But I think what you're pointing to becomes more and more important as the hegemony or the kind of oligopoly of the small number of very big publications is replaced, which is what's happening, with a larger number of kind of, you know, smaller groups and potentially a lot of citizen journalists and startup media organizations. You know, the almost monopoly that you had when you had one newspaper delivered and it was on the kitchen table every morning, that no longer exists. And so, yeah, how do we replace the inherent system of credibility and reviews and checks and balances that we had there with something that kind of is more scalable? I think that's like a really good problem for people to think about.
What did you think about the whole Rachel Maddow tax returns thing? To me, it was so obviously obvious that Trump released it because all the good parts were missing. And it was like probably the only one he ever paid. And she built up, and she had a lot of viewers, but I don't know if that necessarily helped her in terms of credibility.
I know, yeah. I mean, look, I mean, I had a similar reaction, but it's totally speculative. So, of course, I have no idea. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see MSNBC's evolution a little bit. You know, I think Rachel Maddow's great, and you know, that was interesting. I mean, the tax return thing's incredible, right? I mean, nobody thought anybody would run for office and just go, I'm not going to release them.
Yeah.
And of course, it was this rotating series of excuses. You know, I'll do it later. I'll do it after this audit, which actually doesn't matter, but I'm going to pretend it matters. And then finally, they were just like, yeah, no, nobody really cares about that. We're not going to do it. It's just you journalists that care. And then you survey the audience, or you survey the population. Actually, you know, 2/3 or 60% or something of Americans actually do care, and they do want him to release them. But, you know, that's kind of, he's there now. He doesn't have to do anything he doesn't want, at least, you know, not unless the, you know, Congress chooses to remove him.
Yeah, well, they have a majority in both houses, so we'll see about that. But I think it's a very interesting time because there are so many people that are kind of knocked out of being complacent and actually doing something. I know I personally call my representatives at least a couple times a week and telling them my concerns and what I want them to do, but they are pretty much on the same side that I'm on. So even though they need to hear that, it is really important. But I mean, just making a phone call, apparently that does actually matter.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are starting to think really carefully about this space between advocacy and media. You know, we read about things that are going on in the world because we want to know what to do. And I think, you know, one of the elements of the old model that I think people are challenging now is this notion that there's this, you know, massive wall between what's going on and what do you do about it, you know. But the reality is a lot of people send articles around, a lot of people share stuff on Facebook because they're passionate about an issue. You know, they're upset about Trump, they're upset about attacks on immigrants and, you know, racism and, you know, and attacks on women. And so, you know, what is the role of media when it comes to advocacy, you know, and what is the role of advocacy with media organizations? You know, should they be helping to promote articles that they find, you know, important for the other side to see? Should we find ways to package those up better? I mean, should they drive people to act once they've read or consumed content, you know, more directly? Right now, you sort of read an article, you get upset, and then you're like, well, what do I do? And you've got to kind of figure that out separately. You know, there are really interesting groups that are now starting to think about the space between the article and the action, and could you close that gap a little bit?
I think that's a really interesting point. Something that I recently just learned, I am in PR, so I do bug reporters a lot, but just being a regular person emailing, you know, like writing letters to the editor or messaging the New York Times and saying something you want to hear more about. And if enough people are doing that, just like with, you know, your representatives, then they have to pay attention to that.
It's totally true. Yeah. I mean, fewer people do that than you'd think, which means if you do it it's going to have more impact than you might expect. And journalists and editors listen now much more than they used to. You know, the New York Times executive editor is a great guy, Dean Baquet. You know, he will often tell a story in public forums about how, as a rookie journalist, you know, if a reader ever kind of got through to him on the telephone, he'd just like slam it down because, like, what are you doing? Stop wasting my time. I'm reporting. But you know, that doesn't cut it anymore. And now he's kind of the boss of the newsroom. It's very clear that, you know, readers and their opinions and what they're interested in and what matters to them and, frankly, what's going to get them to subscribe are important topics that everybody has to think about a little bit. And I think, you know, one way that's obviously really clear is the distribution of journalism. You know, previously that was the job of the dudes in the blue overalls out in the printing presses to distribute and get up first thing in the morning and, you know, throw it over your fence. Now about, you know, half of the distribution is done by social media platforms, and often that means the journalists themselves are out there tweeting it out, you know, Facebook sharing it, engaging in conversations. So, you know, they're kind of taken on part of the role that the paper boy used to have, frankly. And, you know, that's really interesting. I mean, and some of them are really great at it. I mean, you know, to plug someone I don't know but I follow every day, you know, Maggie Haberman, when it comes to this White House Trump stuff, she's got a fantastic Twitter account. You know, it's got all kinds of up-to-the-minute interesting stuff. I mean, I'm sort of addicted to refreshing that and seeing what she's discovered, and, you know, it turns into articles sometimes, but you kind of get that fresher take on it.
Well, and I know some reporters are paid like this. I don't know how it works in the New York Times or if it's just contributors or what, but I know some of them get paid for how many views that they get on their article.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, right? I mean, I think that's a fascinating debate. Certainly, I'm not aware that any of the big publications like the Times do that, but I think it is true that that's a model that smaller publications experiment with.
I know Forbes doesn't.
Yeah, with the blogger network, probably they do. You know, look, it's a bit of a dangerous one, right? Because, you know, if you're the editor, if you're the boss of the newsroom, your job's to create this overall kind of responsible experience. And there are just obvious traps you can fall into as a reporter. You know, writing clickbait, writing a sensationalistic stuff is always going to deliver the clicks. And if you're the editor, you kind of want the clicks, but you don't want them through that sort of sensationalistic path. So if you incentivize people too directly on the basis of precisely their traffic numbers, it can be kind of a dangerous way to do it. You know, it's a difficult one. You've got to get the balance right. You can't ignore it, but you don't want to just sort of hitch everybody's wagon directly to those metrics.
Yeah, I mean, if no one's reading the article, then it's like,
right,
it doesn't
something's going wrong.
Exist.
But, you know, the unfortunate reality, I mean, sort of like the, you know, Brussels sprouts versus dessert, right? I mean, you don't want to eat your Brussels sprouts. Just like, you probably don't want to read the long story about Syria. You know, it's depressing. People are dying. I haven't kind of figured out exactly what all of the different parties are doing. But, you know, a lot of people getting in a lot of trouble there is news, and it's important and people need to cover it. And it's never going to get the clicks that, you know, a celebrity gossip scandal will get. But it's important. And so editors and responsible, you know, journalistic outfits have to find the right way to, you know, put energy behind that stuff, even though they don't get the payoff in terms of page impressions.
Well, okay, you just mentioned something. There's so much media attention on celebrities, and it kind of dominates our news cycle. And it's is that just because people are willing to consume it? I mean, is there a responsibility to kind of curb down on it? I mean, even as a celebrity, they don't have any privacy. And I'm not saying, woe is them. But it's gotten to the point of being completely absurd. And they're manipulating the media by creating these fake stories in order to get more attention on themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, right? I mean, where the demand that those stories are meeting, you know? I mean, all of us click on it. But, yeah, it's a continuum from the serious story to the slightly lighter story that's equally substantive to the celebrity gossip story to, you know, there's all kinds of content on the internet that goes even beyond celebrity stories, you know, and I think, you know, look, people have sort of base needs and they have base interests and they're not always just about, you know, what's important to the world. So it's a tough one, right? I mean, I think really part of the answer is that organizations build their brand and they build their mission around some range on that spectrum, you know, and I think if they have mission creep, you know, like they're about hard news, they're about serious stories, they're about something important, and they go too far into the kind of, you know, territory of celebs and gossip and titillation and animal videos, you know, ultimately that they can't sustain that brand positioning. And so I think, you know, you've got the cat video site, you know, you've got the you know, you've got the pornography sites, frankly, which is a much even bigger, you know, source of traffic and clicks and impressions.
Pornography news. Which is not a great idea.
Probably exists. Probably exists. I think you can watch it even. I lived in Russia briefly, and I think there was a channel that had a like sort of topless news service.
Oh, yeah.
So you may have just reinvented something that's a winner.
What can we do? What can, you know, regular people or non-journalists do to kind of push the media in a positive direction and kind of support the more on the truth level than that?
I mean, look, I think number one is subscribe to organizations that you judge personally you can trust. You know, I've got some subscriptions to foreign publications, you know, Haaretz, for example, that I just think does important work and I want to support them. I don't read it that often, but like they need help.
What is it called?
Oh, it's called Haaretz. It's an Israeli publication, sort of a progressive publication, and you know, has a nice attempt to kind of cover issues there from both sides, which is nice. You know, so I read that. You know, obviously you've got a Times subscription. You know, the Post I think does great work. So you know, that's what I find interesting. But people need to make these judgments for themselves. But they need to recognize that if nothing's coming out of their wallet to support the hard work being done by journalists, you know, often risking their lives. Often taking on powerful figures that are prepared to attack them mercilessly, you know, who's going to do it? The ad revenue, trust me, is not enough. So, yeah, subscribe to stuff, but then, you know, give them feedback as well, you know, comment, like you said, you know, call up, write in, you know, potentially write their own blogs, you know, share stuff they think is important, you know, consider ways that they can come up with new innovative ideas to solve some of these problems. I think, you know, there's a kind of a real hunger for cool ideas and innovation and entrepreneurship, frankly, in this space right now. And, you know, we got enough sort of ride-sharing services and enough kind of ways to get great sort of food delivered to our apartments in Manhattan. Maybe some cool new ideas about how to solve the trust problems in news and the distribution problems and the monetization problems. You know, that's the kind of stuff we need.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I know you didn't super want to talk about what you're working on now, but is that okay. Kind of the are you going to be supporting projects like that if people want to work on things? Can they?
Yeah, I mean, totally. If there are people interested, yeah. I mean, for the audience, I was telling Margot that it's not like an elevator pitch yet around the things I'm working on, so it's not particularly you know, down pat. But yeah, New Economy Lab is definitely like working very actively on some of these questions and, you know, looking for people that are smart and have things to contribute on them. You know, we've got 3 or 4 active projects thinking about, you know, the intersection between news and advocacy, the way that we distribute social news and the way that we get actions and responses from people that contribute to a more thoughtful debate rather than sort of just Facebook flame wars or ha-ha-haing or angry sad faces, you know, in response to articles. And so, yeah, we're definitely kind of thinking about this stuff a lot and working pretty hard on it.
In terms of writing, when you mentioned before about advocacy and giving people actionable things to do, is that something that you guys are encouraging? And do you think big news organizations are going to start going in that direction?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, it's ultimately an editorial positioning question. So I think some already have. If you go to The Guardian, for example, the former editor there, Russ Bridger, ran active campaigns on climate change on the front page and pushed people to take action, to donate, to sign up, you know, because for him, and frankly, I share this view, you know, that issue has just gone beyond the kind of like, you know, hey, let's just cover it dispassionately. Like, we're actively destroying the planet. And it's like gone beyond the point where you can just sort of pretend that there are kind of 2 different sides here to just cover in any kind of equal way or stay out of it. So, you know, that's consistent with The Guardian's editorial position. I think other publications, that's much more of a leap. And so I think naturally and understandably, they're kind of more hesitant to cross that chasm. They're not going to actively kind of use their real estate to directly support, you know, advocates, you know, apart from their kind of opinion columns, etc. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's an evolution in that space. But then, you know, there's other ways you can solve it. So, you know, there are some interesting groups. There's a company that I've been working a little bit with called has a product called Action Button. They're called Speakable. And they're looking at ways that, you know, you can separate out the layer of action from the publication itself. You know, they do some work with Vice and I think Guardian, actually, and I think Huffington Post. And in that way, by separating the 2 organizations out, you know, it's not Vice saying to do this action, but, you know, Action Button has its space on their page and it curates the actions you can take. So I think there are interesting, you know, creative ways that you can help the user do what the user wants to do without necessarily kind of infringing on the editorial independence of the media organization to the extent that that's how they want to position themselves.
Oh, that's really cool. I've definitely read some articles where it talks about, you know, tweet this number and then it'll tell you all the, and with your zip code, and you get all your representatives' phone numbers and names and you can call them and maybe even some scripts. I when we talked about trust, like Bernie Sanders, I trust him. So I follow him on Facebook and Twitter, and he'll, one thing that I thought was interesting with this whole selling of our browser history that Congress voted for and having different groups, like the guy who did Cards Against Humanity, and then there's a couple other ones, Bernie tweeted one, with having GoFundMes to buy those Congress members who voted yes on this, their browser history. And I think the Cards Against Humanity guy was just going to buy it. He wasn't raising money.
That's going to be great to look at.
I think it might be horrifying and scary.
Oh, well, you know how these stories all end. I mean, you know, like how many, you know, homophobic, you know, pastors have, you know, been caught in hotel rooms with their same-sex, you know, call boys. It's happened just too many times.
Yeah, it's, you know, they'll protest too much.
I know, exactly.
That's why we know Trump is a Muslim. Mexican. He's a Mexican Muslim.
I thought you were against the fake news, Margot. Yeah.
Well, I'm just, you know,
I want sources for that assertion.
I bet we can find some. We'll do 23andMe.
Right, check it out. Yeah. You never know. You never know. Have you ever done that?
Oh, yeah. And it's funny because people always wonder what my ethnicity is.
So what's the answer? Have you revealed this on your program before?
Yeah, I think I did, because I had this amazing Armenian prodigy violinist who was making her Carnegie Hall debut. And so I'm half Armenian, half Polish, and people always guess that I'm Italian or Spanish.
Armenian's a hard one to guess, because, I mean, you don't meet that many Armenians, do you?
Well, there's a lot of them on TV.
Right, is it like the Kardashians? Uh-huh. Yeah. Are you a little bit Kardashian, maybe? Do you think?
No.
You
might? No. No, not at all.
It's not like Genghis Khan. We all have, like, you know, Genghis Khan has like a million descendants. It's not like the Kardashians or...
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them were murdered, you know.
I guess that's true.
Not that long ago.
Just took that in a really depressing direction.
Yeah, but when I did 23andMe, it was crazy because it said most of my like genetics were from in Southern Europe. So actually, literally, my genetics are from all these places people think that I am, but
maybe
background, I'm
emigrated
not.
To Armenia in a past generation.
Probably hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
I guess we all immigrated from somewhere.
Yeah, but it was just kind of interesting that what people think I am gene-wise, I am actually from those places.
Because radio doesn't great. Make it easy to guess your ethnicity.
Yeah, well, I don't know. People say I have an accent sometimes too, and they can't guess where I'm from.
Yeah, I can hear that. I can see why people would say that.
Well, you have an accent.
I have an accent.
Do people guess you're English a lot?
I mean, I get random stuff. Like, to be honest, like, I moved over here in 2001 originally, and there weren't that many Australians here at that time because it was harder to get a visa in 01. And honestly, I was living in Williamsburg. I would go out, and I would say on an average, like, 1 to 2 weeks basis, somebody would say, "Oh, you're from Australia, but you speak such good English." To the point where, like, I had ready to go, like, the nice way of kind of, I didn't want to, like, make them feel too dumb, but I needed to explain this to them. Like, I had a kind of canned response to that. But you don't get that anymore. Now it's just Australians everywhere because we got this visa. I mean, you know the story about why there's so many Australian visas, right?
No, why?
It was a deal between George W. Bush, and the conservative Prime Minister of Australia at the time. Basically, the deal was Australia supports the Iraq War, brings troops, then we get, like, given a special kind of visa. So this E3 visa, only Australians. It's like an entire visa category that only Australians can apply for. And it's like basically H1B, except, like, an infinite number. They never expire. We never hit the quota. And even worse, like, the deal, even worse, but the deal with the Australian government was that the Australian troops that are sent have to be stuck somewhere right on the edge where there's no danger anyone's going to shoot at them. because they just like
name like we have support like, of Australia.
It was purely so he could say, oh yeah, and the Australians are there. They've sent 500 guys or whatever. I don't know actually what the number was. It may be more than that, but definitely the agreement was that they would not be kind of put anywhere too bad.
And so are the visas still around?
The visas still around to this day, yeah.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah, and now there's, I think, actually roughly 10 times. I mean, I saw the numbers. I don't totally remember them, but I think it was like there's about 10 times more Australians now than there were in 2001 in New York.
Wow, that's so funny. I mean, there's even Australian bars and Australian restaurants.
I know, right? There was really nothing. I'd hear the accent occasionally on the street and I'd be like, oh, you're from Australia? Where are you from? Now I'm just like, oh my God. I was here. I found this place before you did.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy to me the time difference and really how far away it is. It's,
yeah, it's
hard
really
to have meetings with them. When I have to talk to people in Australia, I'm just like, geez, it's the next day over there.
It does. It really impacts your relationships because it's you're just on a different... You know, you're on a different time zone. You know, you're about to go to bed and they're waking up. And it's kind of, you know, you can't have that call that you can just have when you're both sort of falling asleep or whatever. You want to call your parents or, you know, you've got some close friend. It's actually really hard to maintain relationships across those two time zones. Yeah, it's like 14-hour difference.
Yeah.
It takes you a day to get there. If you leave now, you arrive basically 24 hours later in Australia. And then you're kind of jet lagged with the absolute worst jet lag that's physically possible because it's exactly the other side of the world.
Yeah. I was looking at flights to New Zealand and I was like, whoa. And when flying from New Zealand to Hawaii, you actually go backwards in time. It's like the day before. I was like, that's crazy. I was leaving on like, let's say Tuesday and then I get there on Monday.
Yeah. And then you, then you go back the other way and you lose it all again. I think it works the other way. But yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow. So that must be hard. Your family's still there?
Yeah, family's all there mostly. I have an aunt here in the city. She kind of moved over.
After the visa program?
No, she predated that.
Oh, wow.
She moved over before you could even be a dual national. So she was not even in America for about 20 years because you used to have to choose what your citizenship was and you weren't allowed to have both. And that changed some time in the last decade, I think. So you can be both now. Actually, that's the reason that Rupert Murdoch is an American. Even though he was born in Australia and sounds like an Australian, because he couldn't be a dual national and you had to be an American citizen to own media companies here.
Oh.
So he gave up his Australian citizenship to become an American so he could own media companies.
I haven't heard much about him lately.
Well, he's getting old a little bit, isn't he? I think he lives in Manhattan and hangs out here.
I know where he used to live.
Really? Well, you probably don't want to reveal that.
I know.
Like... burning pitchforks outside there. No, I mean, you know, look, I'm sure he's a nice guy if you meet him, but he's certainly made America a worse place and the world a worse place.
Yeah. It's, why is he so focused on America and not Australia?
Big market. Look, every Australian kind of, you know, it's fascinating here because you guys, there's like 15 times more of you. So if you do anything that involves, you know, speaking English, you kind of, you want to be here if you want to make it sort of a larger thing.
You want to be, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere.
Someone should write a song about that.
Yeah, about America in general. Even though, I don't know, it's kind of going a little downhill now, at least in the international view.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, some tarnishing of the brand. That's true.
Like, how can you make Brexit look good? I don't know. Elect Trump.
I know.
Like, Brexit was a huge thing, and... now it's just like, well, we have our own issues to deal with right now.
I remember the time everyone's like, God, I mean, imagine if that actually happened. Imagine if that meant Trump got in.
How can people find you? We have to wrap this up right now.
Oh, yeah. James@neweconomylab.com.
Awesome.
So that's your email.
Awesome. Thank you so much. You were amazing. We
no
learned
worries.
A
this
lot.
This is super fun. Thanks for having me. This is cool.
Cool. And I'm very interested in this Australian visa thing. That's like a really good fact.
Well, you'll never get one, I'm sorry to say.
What's your Twitter?
Oh, Twitter is JSLEZ, JSLEZ. So, yeah, find me on Twitter.
Cool, and people can apply to your...
they can all apply with all my many vacancies to fill.
Oh, really?
There's a few, yeah. We're looking for great technologists, great product people, data scientists, and user interface designers. So
cool.
That's the main ones.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Yay!